And as we approach this topic, I want to just at the very beginning point out four themes that you'll see sort of getting tilled over and over back into all these different principles. And so just watch for them as they pop up. We're going to see the theme of personal responsibility coming up over and over again in all of these different principles. We're going to see the importance of respecting authority coming up again over and over. Objective standards of truth. Read a good chunk of a long essay this week on Marxist moralism, talking about how we've got to get to the point where we understand that moralism and our virtues and our ethics need to be derived by observation of the material world. And God says, no, your morals need to be derived by revelation of my character. And you're living in a culture that has a riptide of those two notions colliding. And we're going to see over and over again the importance of looking to an objective standard of truth and defining what's right and what's wrong. And then lastly, you'll see again repeatedly protection of the innocent, protection of the vulnerable. And so with those four overarching themes in mind, if you've got your Bibles, you can try to follow along. Beginning in chapter 21, verses 12 through 36, when we look at the first principle, the first way in which we can love our neighbors in the context of a fallen world, and that is the principle of defending life, defending life. If there's a central principle here, it's this: human life is to remain inviolate. Human life is to remain inviolate. In each of these sections, it was interesting seeing how they're broken out in the text, and kind of right almost in the actual physical middle of each section, there is a principle verse that sort of lays out the heart of what this section is talking about. And for this particular passage here in verses 12 to 36, I think the central thought is contained in verses 23 to 25 in what is often called the lex talions, the law of the teeth. But if there's any further injury, you shall appoint as penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. What's that all about? Well, in this section of the law, God is giving them rules pertaining to injury. What happens when one member of the community causes injury to another? What are you to do? How are you to resolve that? What does love look like when you've had an injury? And it begins with a set of rules pertaining to injury so severe that it actually merits the death penalty. And the basic principle is this: death for deadly injury. Death for deadly injury. You are not allowed to take life within the community of God. That is something sacred that you must hold as off limits. You cannot take life first by murder. It's stated very clearly in Exodus 21:12, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. That's the basic starting point. In verses 12 through 14, we see laid out that intentionally taking a human life forfeited your life in the law of God. In cases of unintended manslaughter, the accused had a right to flee to places of safety where they could request a trial, where judges would adjudicate whether there was intentionality or if this was an accidental killing. But if it was found that a person had murdered somebody with premeditation in their heart, Yahweh commands them here, drag them even if they're holding on to my very altar and kill them. In verse 20, significantly, it is also particularly stated that a slave who is struck so that he dies will, in the NASB, it says be punished, and that sounds a little softer. As a translation here, I like the ESV better, which renders it, he shall be avenged, which is actually closer to the Hebrew word there. Taking the life of a slave opened up the owner to full legal action for murder. Because it is the sanctity of human life, not some station, class, or rank of human life, but human life itself that God is protecting. If you cause injury to another, we'll see a little later, you need to pay for the economic loss of that person. But if you injure your slave, you can see there in verse 21, you don't pay for the loss of economic time because you lost your economic time by injuring your slave. But we will notice in a little bit later, To injure your slave as well as to kill him, both subjected you to legal punishment. You cannot take life by murder. You also cannot take another person's life through theft. Look at verse 16. To kidnap or to steal a human life, whether to keep for yourself or to sell to others, is an affront to love so severe that it also commanded the death penalty. We've discussed in previous messages that there was a sanctioned and protected place for voluntary slavery among the Jews, but it was never the case that chattel slavery, racial slavery, dehumanizing slavery, or slavery involving the stealing of others was permitted among the people of God. It was condemned in the strongest terms, and it bore the highest penalty. You cannot steal the life of another. However, not all life-taking is a direct act of murder. And God also addresses the issue of reckless endangerment. Reckless endangerment. If you look at verses 22 to 23 and verses 29 to 31, you'll see that if you act in such a way, typically out of anger, where you recklessly endanger the innocent, you're still liable for your unintended consequences. In verses 22 to 23, it gives the example of two fellows getting into a fight, and in the midst of that fight, they unintentionally strike a pregnant woman in the middle of that quarrel, such that injury comes to either her or her unborn child. And note that it says, injury that is fatal to the mother or to her unborn child shall be punished life for life. You could face the death penalty for causing a miscarriage. And here is one of the more powerful and clear defenses in Scripture of the sanctity of the life of the unborn. Human life is to be inviolate, and that does not matter if it is the aged, if it is the young, or if it is the unborn, if it is the free man or the slave. You do not have the right to take the life of another intentionally or through the foolishness of your reckless actions. And then looking down at verses 29 to 31, note this, even if your animal gores somebody else to death, and it's an animal that has had the habit of doing this previously, you are considered liable, including the death penalty, for having allowed a known danger to your neighbor to remain unaddressed. The responsibility that we have towards others extends not just to our own person, but to those things underneath our sphere of authority, to those things for which we are responsible. And it is our responsibility as individuals to ensure that that which we are overseeing, if it is a known danger and risk to the life of others, is not allowed to bring injury. And then perhaps the more interesting one in this list, given that all of the things so far have largely resulted in death, you now have verses 15 and 17, where we see rejecting authority singled out for the death penalty, explicitly in the context of children and their parents. We'll probably have more children in here second service, but if there are any in here now, be afraid. They might seem out of place here, as I said, but they are actually essential to the logic of the law and for the people of God. In verse 15, if you strike your parents, you're subject to the death penalty. In verse 17, if you curse your parents, and that word also means to revile or to denounce your parents, you're subjected to the death penalty as well. What's going on here? Well, here's the thing. Every child needs to learn the absolutely critical lesson of submitting to authority. To God overall, and to every level of human authority that God has legitimately ordained. The integrity of every civilization depends on this. Every civilization. And it is in the home that this is developed. Parents are the first authority to which a human is to be subject. And they are, in that sense, a proxy for all other authorities, including God's authority. And God is here putting his finger on an important principle. Blatant, willful rejection of parental authority is an indication that a young person is incapable of loving either God or man. You cannot have love without proper obedience. And removing youth whose hearts are completely given over to rebellion was a necessary safeguard against the kind of lawless revolt that has overtaken so many civilizations. How many nations have fallen at the hands of raging young people with no respect for authority? Perhaps ours will be added to the list. And so for those of us in the room that are parents, we must teach our children to respect authority, not in a cowering way because they'll bolt the instant they have the opportunity. And don't make this an exasperating process, or you and I are also in sin, as Paul warns us in Ephesians. But we must work diligently so that our children would see authority as a blessing and submit in appropriate ways with joy. Otherwise, we're releasing social terrorists into the world. And that will be the mortal enemy of a loving community. These laws make it clear that God could not be more serious about the importance of this. You don't see a lot of laws that say kill young people, but here are two. But there are other types of injury that did not merit the death penalty, but called instead for the taking of complete responsibility for the consequences of your actions. And so we see in the last half of this section the responsibility that we have for non-deadly injury. And that begins by restitution for foolishness. Restitution for the consequences of foolishness. In verses 18 to 19, interestingly, we note that if two men decide to get into a dumb fight, the law is actually not particularly interested. The law was not meant to prevent all forms of human stupidity. There is actually some wisdom in that principle. You cannot legislate stupidity out of a society. However, if a person escalates that fight by using a tool or a weapon and causes significant injury to the other person, then he was required to both compensate the other person for all the lost work that he was now going to suffer because of his injury, and he was personally responsible to ensure that that individual was nursed back to health. So if you're going to be dumb, you bear the consequences. In verses 22 to 27, using the extreme case again of injuring an innocent pregnant woman in the midst of a quarrel with someone else, we are given that set of law codes that we started this section with. A person who injured another as a result of anger and as a result of recklessness was to receive in his person the same injury as he had caused. Life for life, tooth for tooth, eye for eye, burn for burn. And it was interesting to read early scholarship, especially liberal scholarship on this section, talked about what a brutal and primitive law code this was. But more recent scholarship has actually recognized this as a very important evolution in the concept of law that sets the Old Testament law code apart from all of its ancient Near Eastern comparisons. In this regard, almost every other law code for injury required only a financial fine. What's wrong with that? It gives the rich a get-away-with-anything card. Sure, I can put out the eye of somebody I'm annoyed with, and if the law eventually catches up with me, I'll just chuck a bag of money at his relations. Done. This law said, no matter your station in life, you bear in your own body the consequences of your sin. And that is a very different kind of deterrent and warning for somebody who would recklessly endanger the lives of others. God's law is impartial, it is fair, and it is sober enough to get the attention of a slave and a king at the same time. Verses 33 to 34 and verse 36 describe carelessness, such as leaving a pit exposed or allowing a violent ox around your neighbor's ox. In these cases, you bore the full loss of the other person personally and made restitution. In a fallen world, though, not every loss that is suffered is the result of foolishness or sin. It can be the result of living in a fallen world where bad things happen. And it is also important that God's law allows for this. And so we see in verses 28 and 35 that God does allow for accidents in his law. And even in our own homes and our own dealing with others, there needs to be allowance for accidents. Verse 28, if your ox gores someone to death, an ox that before had been just a very nice little ox, you're not liable for that death. It was not something that you were reasonably expected to have been able to foresee or prevent. And so you were let go. There is no restitution here, because what restitution could there be for a life? It is a tragedy, but it is one for which the owner is not responsible. In verse 35, again, if your ox, and oxen must have been very unpredictable animals, right? They were just like such convenient go-tos for when something bad happens, you know, like an ox. That's just sort of the go-to animal here. If your ox gets into a fight with your neighbor's ox and they're both going at it, and your ox wins and gores theirs to death, you share the loss. You share the loss. You split it 50-50. Here's the dead animal. We cut it in half. We each get half the meat. Here's the living animal. We sell it off. We split the proceeds 50-50. Because dumb ox get into fights sometimes. But if your ox had gored somebody else's ox before, and you hadn't done something about that ox, then you bore the entire economic weight yourself. Do you see how the goal of these laws is not economic parity? The goal of these laws is to deal with issues of the heart. It is to govern love. And so it runs along the lines of personal responsibility, not just pragmatic outcomes. A few quick lessons here. Love demands that we value all human life. Love demands that we value all human life. We don't have arbitrary standards of personhood. We don't have arbitrary standards of rights differentials. This person's healthier and more important to society than that person, so their preferences are more important than their rights. To be a loving community that honors the image of God that humans bear, we must value all human life. And therefore, love demands we avoid all human injury. We recognize others' rights to their own human sanctity. And we would not ever do anything intentionally through reckless neglect or by being careless with that over which we are responsible in such a way that it would bring injury to others. And love demands that we take responsibility for our actions. And that's going to be a theme, as I said, we'll see repeated over and over. And boy, do we need to teach that. We need to model that. We need to teach that. Our culture desperately needs a huge dose of personal responsibility. Amen? It should see it in us first. And it must see it in us first. But our call to love, as we're going to see next, extends beyond just our neighbor's life and health. It includes his or her property and the stewardship that God has entrusted with them as well. And so secondly, this morning, we look at the principle of respecting stewardship, respecting another person's stewardship in chapter 22, verses 1 through 15. And our central principle here is this. Restitution is the first step in restoring trust. Restitution is the first step in restoring trust. Our key verse in this section is Exodus 22, verse 9, which says, "For every breach of trust, whether it is for ox, for donkey, for sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, 'This is it,' the case of both parties shall come before the judges, and he whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor." For every breach of trust, restitution is the first step to resolve it. All theft is a breach of trust. And notice that that's how theft is framed. It's an attack on love. And as Christians, we are called to love even the untrustworthy. But it is significant that our ability to love the untrustworthy is actually predicated on our ability to trust the God who calls us to love them. And so underneath all meaningful love, there will eventually be a trust relationship. And God means to establish the importance of that in his people. And God has a good deal to say here about respecting the boundaries of ownership and stewardship among his people, beginning first of all in the restitution required for theft. Verses 1 through 4 and verse 7. Verse 1, we see here that stealing what a man needs for his livelihood, his flocks, his beasts of burden, required a particularly high restitution because you're not only stealing his possessions, but you're stealing his ability to fulfill his responsibilities. In verses 3 through 4 and verse 7, you can see the more general principle, whether it's for possessions or for money, anything that you have stolen, whether you kept it for yourself or whether you sold it, you paid double what you had taken. That was the basic principle. And if you were not able to do so, you couldn't claim poverty, you lost your freedom. You were sold into slavery to make up your debt. Also a note for those Second Amendment lovers in the room. Self-defense is here mentioned very explicitly. And there's also an important point mentioned along with it. A person was understood by God to have the right to protect himself and his family from harm, especially at night. A thief entering a house at night just to rob somebody was in mortal danger. Because as it says there in verse 2, that a person has the right to lethally defend his family at night from an intruder. However, notice importantly, he does not have the right to take him out after the sun comes up. Because he is not allowed to use lethal force to defend his possessions, only his people. Lethal force was allowed to protect human life, not stuff. And so when the sun was up, you were allowed to try to protect your property, but you were not allowed to do so to the point of taking another person's life. You also see in verse 5, restitution for intentional damage. You allowed your field to get eaten down to the point where there's no more food for your cattle, so you just happened to accidentally let them go and graze your neighbor's field. You pay back twofold. Restitution for unintentional damage. You're cold, so you build a fire. And that fire does what fires like to do, and it spreads and takes out your neighbor's grain stacks. You pay double. I wasn't trying to burn his field down, but you did. And so you take responsibility for your actions. And then there are a number of special cases. What happens when I ask my neighbor to keep something and then the animal gets sick and dies or runs away when nobody's looking? What happens when there is the unavoidable loss of entrusted goods? In verses 10 through 11 and verse 13, we see that scenario. And just as we saw earlier where God made an allowance for accidents in the world, so we see here. If you go to the judges and you are able to swear and prove that you did not by your hand, your carelessness, or through trickery bring about the loss of this animal or this good, but that it was lost due to unavoidable natural circumstances beyond your control, you were not liable. However, you were expected to be responsible for what you had in such a way that somebody else couldn't come along and steal it. And so if what you were taking care of for somebody else was stolen, if you can't find the thief, you paid double restitution. And then finally, borrowed goods in verse 14. If you borrow something from somebody else, it doesn't matter what happens, you are responsible for it, and you make restitution. For shared or hired goods, the principle is this. If the owner is present, the owner is the one who is responsible. And if an owner hires something out for money, it's assumed the owner has taken liability for unexpected loss. And so the responsibility is on the owner. The last category of theft is one that is perhaps the most interesting to us today and the most initially opaque, but it is actually this, the theft of sex. The theft of sex. In verses 16 to 17, and this is the one that initially raises, I think, some hackles for modern readers, but it's a very important principle. First of all, and for you parents of young people, you might need to tune in on this one. It may come as a surprise, but there are situations in which young men and women choose to jump to the pleasures of marital union before bothering with the actual marital part. Like this actually happens from time to time in society. So what do you do when that happens? In the ancient world, a father was understood to be responsible for the protection of his family, and in a unique way was meant to be a covering of protection for his wife and for his daughters in a world in which being a single woman was a very vulnerable and dangerous position to be in. A young man seducing a daughter had thus come in and stolen the stewardship that father had over his daughter. He was a thief, guilty before God, guilty before the young woman, and guilty before her father. And these verses ensure that that theft is borne by the man and not by the daughter. Having unlawfully taken something that might have been lawfully sought later in a marriage, he must now seek to make it right. And so he must pay the marriage dowry and commit himself to the responsibilities of marriage. And as we find clarified later in the law, in that case, a marriage, he is not allowed for any reason to ever terminate in a divorce. This is how he will seek to make it right. And then it is the father's prerogative to decide, is this a diamond in a particularly rough condition? Then I can allow my daughter to marry him. But he also had the right to say, you are not the kind of person with the kind of character that will ever be marrying my daughter, and still take the dowry, because restitution is still being made for the theft of that stewardship, for his violation of that trust. Notice again, it is the man who is bearing the responsibility, not the daughter. There has been a good deal of intentional and sometimes also innocent misrepresentation of this passage, and it was sad to see how many places I found criticizing the Bible for declaring here that whenever a woman is raped, she has to marry her rapist. That is not what this passage is teaching. The seduction here is under the assumption that she was a willing participant. And notice, even in the case of being a willing participant, she doesn't bear the responsibility. Adultery, when a woman is betrothed or married to another man, or a man is betrothed and married to another woman, adultery brings the death penalty, because both of them have not just presumptuously tried to jump ahead and do a potentially lawful thing too early, but they have broken a marriage covenant. In that case, both were put to death. But in Deuteronomy 22, verses 25 to 27, it teaches very clearly that in the case of rape, the law is clear. You kill the rapist and you hold the woman guiltless. And it is as simple as that. This is not a law condoning men getting to take women for themselves by force. It is actually a law protecting women from those kind of men. Some lessons here. First, don't take what's not yours. Don't take what's not yours. But I'm entitled to it. Do you have the title for it? Then it's not yours. Do not take what is not yours. Always take responsibility for your actions. There's a big difference with children. I'm learning this. Between coming in and finding something broken on the floor and saying to your son or your daughter, did you break that? And whether or not the first thing out of their mouth is, yes, I did, it was an accident, or, but I didn't mean to. We must have as a first reaction to situations the desire to take responsibility, even if it was an accident. And that's part of that last principle, refuse unlawful shortcuts. Just refuse unlawful shortcuts in life. Whether it's trying to get more money, whether it's trying to get more attention, don't take credit for an idea that's not yours. Don't take credit for an accomplishment for which you are not solely responsible. Don't take sexual pleasure that you are not granted by God. Don't take unlawful shortcuts. Which brings us to the sort of second half of our principles this morning, and these are briefer, beginning with this one. Maintain holiness. And this is sort of what they're all leading to in a big picture in the law. maintain holiness. The central principle here being that Yahweh's people need to live Yahweh's way. Yahweh's people need to live Yahweh's way. In Exodus 22, verse 31, he says very simply, "You shall be holy men to me. You shall be holy men to me." And so we see in verse 18, the beginning of a series of commands designed to focus on the holiness of the people of God. And it begins with this principle, reject evil mediators. Reject evil mediators. If you find a sorceress, it says, kill her. And if you're worried about gender equality, later in Malachi, it says, if you find a sorcerer, kill him too. What's up with this? Sorcery is never specifically or narrowly defined in Scripture. It's always a term used broadly to cover the whole range of occultic practices, whether that was seeking to rely on evil power to accomplish miracles here and now, whether it was communing with the dead and seeking to bring them back or to get messages from them. It was an attempt to mediate between the human and the other world apart from Yahweh. And God says, that is not going to happen here. I have the relationship with you. You will come to me because I love you. You will not go to another. He also tells them in verse 19 to reject pagan sexuality. And bestiality is the one that is singled out here. And that is a gross perversion of the symbol of sex that God designed to mark the oneness of a marriage relationship. But it was also a practice very closely associated and identified primarily with pagan fertility and pagan religious ritual. Yahweh is telling his people, your sexuality is never to be used in any way other than the sacred purpose for which I have designed it. You do not have sexual autonomy. Verse 20, we are to reject all forms of idolatry. Rejecting Yahweh was grounds for a total rejection by both Yahweh and his people. That phrase, utterly destroyed, if you're looking in the New American Standard, is literally to put under the ban. That was the technical term God gave for things that were meant to be completely annihilated such that no part of it was ever allowed to be reused or taken for any other purpose. It was to be left in utter ruins. To reject Yahweh was to expose your own spiritual ruin and to subject yourself to the ruin that you brought upon yourself under the law. And then verse 28, back to respecting authority. Holiness required respecting authority, respecting God's authority and respecting the authorities that he has ordained. You cannot curse God. You cannot treat him as, literally as that word means, to treat him as lightweight, to treat him as contemptible, to declare that he is accursed. You cannot do that either for God or for the rulers that he has put over you. A holy people is and always must be a submitted people. And there must be a line separating them from sin that they refuse to cross. And this starts by not having a hard heart towards those that God has put in these positions of authority. And while that does not mean that we cannot call out sin among our leaders, and indeed we must, it does mean we cannot revile or have contempt for those in that position because the position itself demands respect. We must also, next, give God his due. In verses 29 to 30, we give sacrificially to God from our first fruits, not from our leftovers. He is our first priority and not our sort of feel-good bonus investment. We don't give to God to get a tax write-off at the end of the year, if it's convenient. God claimed from his people a representative offering of all that they had, from crops to animals to their very children. Crops and animals that were able to be offered as sacrifices were to be given in a first fruits offering as an actual offering. And animals that were beasts of burden and not fit for sacrifice, or your firstborn children, they were redeemed back by offering an acceptable sacrifice, substituting for them. And that's a principle. Give God his due. Give to God from our best, not from our leftovers. And then lastly, interestingly, the verse where God says, you are going to be holy to me, is a verse about not eating roadkill. Right, that's the one he attaches this specific little summary phrase onto, is don't eat roadkill. We are to maintain dignified standards in our living. As those set apart for God, Israel was to live by a higher standard of dignity. They were not to eat roadkill. And it was more than just a food safety warning, as some commentaries try to lay it out. You're going to be holy, and that'll make you sick. That's not the point of the passage. The point of the passage is you bear my image. You need to act with a certain level of dignity that coincides with that high calling. And so the people of God are to live a life that can be called dignified. And that is why it is also an attribute that is singled out as necessary for the leaders in God's church in the New Testament. We ought to not be afraid, you know, we're not afraid to have fun. Doesn't mean you can't roll on the floor and play with your kids. But there is a line of dignity that we are to maintain in our living that befits those who bear the image of God. So a few quick lessons here. First, know your local idols and reject them. Know your local idols and reject them. What are the forms of false worship, the forms of evil mediation that our culture wants to turn to? And having identified them, reject them utterly and teach your children to do the same. Know that you and your possessions belong to God. Your identity, from being an image bearer of God and even how that expresses for your sexual identity, to all the things that you own belong to God, and He deserves His best, the best from both. And then to summarize that, bear a holy image. Would the people that watch your life say, that is a person who carries themselves with dignity as though they represented someone much greater? That ought to be the way that we carry ourselves. And then finally, we move into two short principles related both to the area of oppression and subjugation. And the first is this, to hate oppression itself. Hate oppression itself. Show grace to the vulnerable or face God's wrath is the principle here. Show grace to the vulnerable or face God's wrath. In Exodus 22:27, you can see, for that is his only covering and his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. Do not oppress strangers. Don't oppress widows. Don't oppress orphans in verses 21 to 24. And we've seen some strong language in this passage already, but perhaps this is the strongest in the entire section that we've looked at this morning. Note what God has to say here in Exodus 22:22-24. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he cries out to me, I will surely hear his cry. Okay. And my anger will be kindled. And I will kill you with the sword. And your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. Widows and orphans are those most likely to have no recourse in society, and to take action against them is something God takes extremely personally. It is a lack of love in the face of the greatest need for love. And he'll turn your family into widows and orphans. He will kill you. Any questions? This is one of those passages where it's like, okay, God. On the flip side of that, as James points out in the New Testament, pure and undefiled religion is what? What is the community of God supposed to be all about? Helping widows and orphans in their distress. Next principle, do not charge interest. Verse 25. It's interesting that the kind of interest debt-driven stranglehold so many institutions in America have over so many of its people is actually flat-out prohibited in Israel. Current possessions, personal labor, are allowed to be put up as collateral for needed capital investment in ancient Israel. But you couldn't steal from a man's future potential earnings in that way. You couldn't steal his ability to regain financial footing by putting him into an interest cycle that he could never escape from. So no interest was allowed to be charged on loans, though you could take capital of physical items. However, the last principle in this section, you cannot withhold collateral from somebody if that collateral is necessary to their survival. If a poor man gives you all he has, his staff and his cloak, you can't hang on to it at the end of the day when he can't yet repay because he'll freeze to death. Which means grace is an operating principle in law here. Grace is an operating principle. And so the lessons are these: hate oppression and never exploit the desperate. Hate oppression never exploit the desperate. Don't let our culture define what those two words are. Let God define them. But as God has defined it, hate oppression and never exploit the desperate. And lastly this morning, preserve justice in chapter 23. And we've spent a long time talking about this passage earlier in our discussion of the ninth commandment, so we'll keep this brief. The central principle here is simple. Justice is objectively righteous or it isn't justice. Justice is objectively righteous or it isn't justice. And the key verse here being verse 7, keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. In verses 1 and 7, you see the importance of not bearing false witness. We've talked about that before. A just community and a loving community abhors the telling of lies to achieve a desired outcome. We are also to avoid all forms of partiality. We cannot be biased on the opinion of a mob. We cannot be biased towards the rich because of what they can do for us. We cannot be biased towards the poor because we like to root for the underdog. We cannot be biased by accepting bribes that distort our objectivity. Love requires that we would be impartial in all matters of justice. We even must respect the rights of our enemies in verses 4 to 5. Love demands that we act as love would dictate, even towards those who don't love us. Even if love is a one-way tether in the society, it must still be upheld. You find your neighbor's goods or properties in distress, you are responsible to do what is kind and return or liberate those, in the case of this law, those animals that are in distress. And do not take advantage of outsiders. The standards cannot be limited to the community itself, but those principles must be shown outside the community as well. The love that they were to have for each other is the same love they were to demonstrate towards those who are outsiders. And they were to never forget the lessons learned by being on the receiving end of cruelty and oppression in Egypt. So the lessons here are this. Know the objective truth. Know it. What is the standard? What is it? What is righteous? And then apply that truth objectively. That should be lived out in our lives. That needs to be taught to our children to live out in their lives. Do we know enough of God's word that we can say this is what is right to do in this situation? And then are we willing to do that without giving consideration to our personal preferences and biases? So, what do we do with all this? It's a lot. It's a lot of law. Well, first, teach these principles to our children. Defend life, respect stewardship, maintain holiness, hate oppression, preserve justice. These principles undergird what it means to love your neighbor in a fallen world. These are the principles that allow us to sort out the mess that arises from sinful people living in sinful situations. They need to be known by us. They need to be taught by us to the next generation. And you're like, well, I don't have any kids. There's all kinds of kids running around here. Just sort of pseudo-adopt some. Get involved in children's ministry. Teach this to the next generation. And then model these principles with our lives. Model these principles with our lives. It's all about love. This is how love looks. And when the world looks at us, if they don't see these things, they won't understand the God that we serve. But if they do see these things, they will see a community operating so differently than the world. And to be set apart from the world is, in fact, actually the definition of holiness. And as the music team comes up to lead us in our closing song this morning, one final application. Be thankful for Jesus. Be thankful for Jesus. These are good laws, amen? Too bad none of us keep them as we should. Israel blew it hardly after they had been given. And we are so often no better. Like Paul, we continually find ourselves in the position of saying, the law is good, but man, does it highlight how bad I am. And so praise be to Christ, whose perfect love underpins both his perfect obedience to the law and his overwhelming grace to lawbreakers like us. We love God's law. It's a reflection of his character. But we do not pretend to be able to fulfill it. We love Christ because he is the one that fulfilled it for us and grants us the life that we don't deserve. And it is therefore our very forgiveness for being lawbreakers that is the primary and greatest motivation that we have for seeking to obey the law. That's cool. And while we are no longer under the law of Moses, as Christ has fulfilled that law, and it is now done away with, the character of God reflected in the principles that we see encoded in this law are aspects of his character that are very much remaining to this day. And I want to challenge you this morning, if you have not in love and gratitude accepted the work of Jesus Christ on your behalf, know that these principles are not just an inspirational ideal to aspire to in life. They are the perfect standard by which your life will one day be judged. And the judgment is on a pass or fail system. Would you today consider abandoning your attempts to be right with God on your own merits and accept the love of a God who understands your guilt but was willing to die for it? And then you will find, as I trust all followers of Jesus find this morning and are encouraged to remember, that the commands of God are life-giving. They are a life-giving guide by which we express our love for God and for others as the forgiven.